Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in, and we're on Twitter at KUOW. Tomorrow is the deadline for North American cities to submit bids to be the home of Amazon's second headquarters. Meanwhile, Seattle leaders are debating whether we've treated Amazon shabbily. Have we driven them into another city's arms with our hostile business environment? A group of elected officials wrote a letter to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos saying if Amazon has felt unwelcome or not included in regional decisions, these regional leaders would like to hit the refresh button. Well, yesterday on this show, I interviewed one of the signers of that letter. Democratic State Senator Guy Palumbo of Maltby says the Seattle socialist echo chamber is demonizing Amazon.
They're blamed for the traffic. They're blamed for housing prices. They're blamed for gentrification. They're blamed for homelessness. You know, you name it, they're blamed for it. So, I mean, I don't think that's a shock to anybody that lives in Seattle that they've been, you know, the whipping boy, essentially, for those issues.
So you can hear that interview at our website, KUOW.org. Today, we talk with a city official who did not sign that letter. In fact, Seattle City Council Member Shama Sawant. Thank you for joining us, by the way, Council Member.
Thank you for having me.
You called this refresh letter disingenuous and craven. Why is that?
The letter, as you mentioned, and as Mr. Palumbo himself mentioned yesterday, suggests that maybe Amazon was made to feel unwelcome, and there's an idea that maybe the city did not do enough to have a partnership with Amazon. Well, let's put these phrases in the context of what's happening in Seattle. Amazon is one of the most profitable corporations in the entire world. One of its major executives, the CEO, Jeff Bezos, is the second richest man in the entire world. And Amazon's first quarter profits, for example, in 2016, were $513 million. Keep in mind, these are profits, not revenues. And the businesses, the taxes on businesses right now, the B&O tax, which is the only tax on business, is less than one half of 1%. So I don't think that Amazon has been made to feel unwelcome in any way whatsoever. Those who are unwelcome in this city are regular working people, and at this point, even the middle class, because of skyrocketing rents, all those hundreds of thousands of people that are being pushed away from this city because they can't afford to live here.
Senator Palumbo yesterday says, separate from tax policy, it's a problem of rhetoric that Amazon is being demonized. This is a company that employs roughly, depending on your math, roughly 2.5% of the workers in the whole region. How much can you blame one company for home prices and congestion and gentrification and homelessness without it seeming like demonization of that company?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind, and certainly as a socialist, I don't believe that Amazon is just one bad apple in a basket full of good apple corporations. I mean, I think this is a consequence of the way the capital system works. But we also should make clear that the reason ordinary working people, it's not just me, by the way, you know, I think Mr. Palumbo should go out on the streets of Seattle, maybe in the grocery stores and other stores, and just walk around and find out what people are thinking. And you'll find out that what I'm thinking about is not that unique. And the reason people are focusing on Amazon is that it is an outsized corporation, but people are also clear that this is the sort of thing that happens when you let corporations have carte blanche on the city's policies. And we also should make clear that the conflict is not with the people who work in Amazon. I mean, I used to be a software engineer, so these are regular working people who are perhaps making better salaries than most other people in Seattle. But in reality, they are not the ones that are the policy drivers. The policy drivers are the billionaires and the politicians who work with the billionaires. So in reality, there is a partnership. There's a partnership between the billionaire class of Seattle and the politicians in City Hall who represent them. What we don't have is a partnership of actual elected representation in City Hall with ordinary working people of the city. And if that's what he is calling a socialist echo chamber, then I think there's not enough of that echo chamber yet. We need to actually seriously address the all-pervasive economic and social and racial inequality in our city.
And it can't
stop at the city. It has to be done at the state level. We need actual corporate taxation.
Speaking of taxes, Councilmember Sawant, how much money does the city get from Amazon directly and indirectly through B&O taxes, sales taxes, real estate taxes? Do you know?
I actually don't know that number. In fact, that's a good number. I will actually go right now and make sure City Hall staff figure that number out. But I can bet you that it's too eclipsed by the amount of profits that they have made. And
shouldn't you know? We're talking about costs and benefits. Shouldn't you know what the benefits are to Seattle? And I mean, that's money you can spend on infrastructure and housing people, et cetera.
Well, you can look at what's happening around the city to know that whatever that dollar figure is, which I'm sure we can find out, and that's not a barrier. The barrier is not knowing the number. The barrier is that the number, whatever it is not enough, because the proof is when you look out in the city, what is happening right now? I mean, can anybody in any honesty say that, in the last several years that affordability has actually become better, not worse? Homelessness has been alleviated, not increased. Can anybody claim that Seattle is a more livable place for working people than a much less livable place? So I think that, you know, we should have a little bit of perspective on reality. And I think it's a lot out of touch with reality for politicians to say that we haven't partnered enough and that we have created, I'm quoting Mr. Pulumba, a hostile environment for Amazon. I mean, this is all going to be news for all those renters who are getting pushed out of the city because the rent is completely unaffordable for them.
Well,
for
Amazon,
them, it's a hostile environment. I also wanted to say, you know, we have to keep in mind what kind of corporation Amazon is. People who like to paint Amazon as some sort of, do-gooder. Let's keep in mind, this is the same corporation that absolutely refused to deal with the glaring problems that were emerging from SIS, that's a security company they contract with, where Muslim workers were not only facing sort of racism in the workplace because they weren't being allowed to pray in the workplace, but also many, many workers have reported their basic labor rights, city labor rights, like paid sick and safe leave and so on, being violated by this corporation.
Councilmember,
what about that accountability?
Senator Palumbo says eventually Amazon might employ more and more people in its new headquarters and fewer people in Seattle. Listen to this.
Absolutely. That is a long-term threat to our economy at the state level and definitely in Seattle. Could you imagine if, 30,000 jobs out of Seattle moved out of Seattle right now? That would be a really big problem. You know, that city budget wouldn't be up at $5 billion anymore. That would be a serious problem.
Council member, would you call it a huge problem if Amazon were to either leave Seattle or even shrink its Seattle headquarters? Would that be a huge problem?
I think losing living wage jobs is always a problem, no matter which city it happens in, because it is working people that are impacted. The problem, though, is that if you accept the logic of Amazon and the politicians who support Amazon's logic, the problem with that is that the only conclusion to that logic is an inevitable race to the bottom. I mean, look at what's happening right now, right? Seattle is not socialist at this moment. The progressive business tax that I'm talking about, at least $200 per full-time employee per year on corporations that I'm hoping to put through in this budget, which will actually, if it goes through, force Amazon to pay $8 million in taxes annually, which I think they should. That's a fair share that they need to pay. That hasn't happened yet, okay? And already Amazon has threatened Seattle by saying that they're going to look at other cities. What is this reminiscent of? This is eerily reminiscent of what Boeing did at the state level. They said, if you don't let us cut pensions of the unionized employees, if you don't give us the largest ever corporate tax handout in U.S. history, then we're going to cut jobs. What happened? The state legislature gave them that deal on a silver platter, and yet they cut jobs. And year after year after year, they have continued cutting jobs. And the reason they're doing that is not that Boeing is especially evil or Amazon is especially evil. This is the problem of a capitalist system.
Well, let's talk about,
if you accept that race to the bottom, what happens is that as long as there's another city that is willing to let its workers language in a worse condition, corporations will move their jobs. So the only solution, the only alternative to this race to the bottom bill is for workers everywhere to say that we want all our cities to be livable cities with living wage unionized jobs. That's the only alternative.
Okay, finally, on the capitalist system, council member, you described Seattle trying to get a better deal from Amazon. There's a proposed head tax on Seattle's highest grossing employers. Cities do that, and companies try to get the best deal they can from cities. As you said, it's capitalism. But is it fair to say that then neither side is the bad guy in this, that it's just business? How do you want us to think about this negotiation?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that this what you call negotiation is not really a negotiation in the sense that if people think of the word negotiation, the picture that comes to mind is that there's some sort of parity between the two sides and, you know, there's a give a little, take a little kind of approach. But that's not the situation we're in. This is a David versus Goliath situation. So it would be inaccurate, regardless of your politics, inaccurate to characterize this as some sort of fair partnership kind of negotiating, give a little, take a little. It's really completely disproportionately imbalanced and completely disproportionately in favor of big business. It's not just Amazon. This is the kind of sweetheart approach that politicians in City Hall have taken towards big developers like Vulcan, to Wall Street speculators. And, you know, it's that whole combination that results in unaffordability, unlivability, and jobs that are good for a few workers, but for the vast majority of workers, you know, they languish in low-wage jobs. So as opposed to negotiations, I would characterize this more accurately as the need for a class struggle approach where workers, ordinary people, activists, those who are driven by social justice, everybody who's listening to this show and you think that Seattle is not livable for you, for us to come together and fight for a better kind of society and understand that in that fight, you are, actually, this is not a neutral ground, you are fighting against the billionaires, you're fighting against corporations, those who are not going to agree with you. I mean, if they agreed with what we were saying, that would be great, but that's not what happens. So, of course, we have to have a struggle approach where it's a question of balance of forces. You know, how strong are you going to build so that you can win $15 an hour, you can win renters' rights, you can win a progressive business tax, hopefully, through this budget. So I would really invite everybody who is watching to join us tomorrow night, Thursday night at 6 o'clock at City Hall for the People's Budget Town Hall, where we're going to be, you know, building a movement, like every year, to win these progressive gains for working people in Seattle.
Seattle City Council Member Shama Sawant talking about class struggle and describing as disingenuous and craven this letter written by some Seattle City Council members, some regional leaders, including Democratic State Senator Guy Palumbo, that letter to Jeff Bezos talking about a refresh button. Again, you can hear my interview yesterday with Senator Palumbo at our website, KUOW.org. Council Member Shama Sawant, thank you for this time.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we'd love to hear what you think. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Our email address is record@kuow.org. Here is another effect of the Seattle boom. Did you know that commercial restaurant rents shot up almost 50% in Seattle in just the past year? This is an issue in the Seattle mayor's race. Here's reporter David Hyde with KUOW's politics team.
Tim Nguyen owns the Tamarind Tree Restaurant in Seattle's Little Saigon neighborhood.
It started because we couldn't find any place that we can have a drink. I think we're the first place in Little Saigon district serving hard liquor, you know, serving martinis.
The menu features dishes like crispy coconut rice cakes with shrimp and, of course, pho, which has been part of the fabric of Seattle culture since the 1980s.
You know, pho fill you up and make you feel so warm, so homey. Nowadays, the non-Vietnamese embrace that as well.
But Nguyen says that feeling is now at risk. The reason? Increased costs. For rent, wages, taxes, food, it all adds up. And for Nguyen, to an extra $40,000 or $50,000 per month. So what does that mean?
Oh, we barely pay ourselves. We have three different siblings working with me, and their wages sometimes lower than when I'm our servant.
On top of that, there's the gnawing uncertainty. Nguyen used to have a lease, but the building owner will no longer renew it. Nguyen says that's because eventually the owner plans to redevelop the entire property. And when that happens, he's not sure he's going to be able to afford to pay the rent or afford to stay open. And that's a concern for lots of restaurant owners in Seattle right now, where rents and prices have skyrocketed since the last recession. So why not just charge more? Nguyen says he's already raised prices, in the case of pho, to $8 or $9 a bowl.
I don't know who would pay a $12 bowl pho or $15 bowl pho.
Both of the candidates running for mayor this year are hearing a lot of stories like this. And for both, commercial affordability is a serious issue.
It's an issue for business owners, for their employees. And talking to business owners, it's clear that our small businesses are really struggling and feeling the pinch of the growth in Seattle right now.
Former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin says she wants developers to build more affordable spaces for small businesses. In exchange, the city could grant them zoning height increases. The city's already doing something like that with affordable housing. Durkin would also eliminate building and occupancy taxes for small business startups.
It is one of the key places where women and minorities, immigrants can start that business, build the future, not just for them and their families, but for their whole neighborhoods and communities. It's a critical piece of who Seattle is.
Urban planner Carrie Moon calls for more progressive business taxes. And she calls Durkin's proposals the Band-Aid approach. Moon thinks more dramatic changes to the Seattle economy are needed.
Like employee shared ownership plans and co-ops, because increasingly access to entrepreneurship, access to ownership, it's harder and harder for folks to reach.
And Moon also supports commercial rent stabilization to set limits on how much landlords are allowed to raise rents. Back at Tamarind Tree, Tam Nguyen says for now, the future just feels uncertain for him, for his family, and for the customers and community who depend on them.
Are we serving our community? Are we serving the folks that eat a bowl of pho when they feel like they need to eat? You know, when their body needs to be treated?
In Little Saigon, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
And you can hear more about the power of pho in KUOW's new podcast, Second Wave. You can listen or subscribe at our homepage, KUOW.org. In a moment, will there be some delicious meals on top of I-90 when wildlife start crossing over that bridge like they're supposed to? Stand by. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If you've driven over Snoqualmie Pass recently, you've probably seen that big archway being built over I-90, just east of the summit. That archway is not for us. It's a wildlife overpass, a bridge made to look like nature with trees and rocks for animals to use so they can safely cross the freeway. Do animals really use bridges? And what happens when the predators figure out where the wildlife crossing is? Here to explain is the director of the I-90 Wildlife Bridges Coalition, Charlie Raines. Welcome to KUOW.
Oh, thank you much, Bill.
What kind of problems do freeways present to wildlife?
Well, we've all seen the roadkill on the side of the freeway, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. Those are the larger animals that have accidents with cars and trucks. But there's a lot of other animals that are just not getting across the freeway, or they're small enough that people don't notice them off onto the side. But they are major barriers, and what we need to make sure we have is, especially in the Cascades, that we have a continuous forest connection from the South Cascades near Mount Rainier through the Alpine Lakes and on up into the North Cascades, if you want a really healthy population of wildlife.
Why? Why is that continuous connection so healthy?
Well, some species, such as deer or elk, migrate on a seasonal basis, and so they have to move through there, and you put a freeway right in the middle of it. They're trying to get from one side to the other. Obviously, it's not very good result in many cases. But if you're going to have a healthy population, especially if you have species that are more endangered, you don't want to have two or three small populations. You want to have one connected population, better for the genetics, better for dealing with climate change, better for dealing with things like epidemics.
You mentioned deer and elk. We're also talking bears, cougars?
Yes, we are.
What else? Foxes?
Fox, wolverine, you know, the whole suite of animals, not just the mammals we've been talking about, but salamanders and even some snakes and others that need to get from one side to the other. Most of them we don't see, most of which will actually use the underpasses. But some prefer to have to use the overpass.
I'm picturing all those animals, and now salamanders included, and it's quite a menagerie in my mind. How do you get animals to cross a freeway where you want them to?
Well, they're going to cross where they have an opportunity to cross. And so the scientist looked at this 15-mile stretch of the freeway and said, where are the most likely places where different species want to cross? Some of them is pretty obvious. It's along a creek that's already there, and you just make sure you have a large enough bridge to cover it, to go across it. In other cases, it might be a dry gully or rocky area or whatever. For different species, they are looking for different habitats. So you design the type of crossing structure for the species that you're looking for in the right places.
But you're talking about so many animals, deer, elk, cougars, frogs, salamanders, you know, mice. How do we be sure that all those different animals actually use that bridge in that spot?
Well, not all of them will probably use that particular bridge, but through the 15 miles of the project, the biologists have studied it carefully, and they believe that the proposal is robust enough that it will provide sufficient permeability to allow wildlife to move from one side of the freeway to the other.
Okay, and after a while, do elk get used to mama elk shows baby elk where to cross, and they get to know the bridge?
It's pretty much the right thing. Up in Banff National Park in Canada, they've had a similar type of an overpass there for, you know, more than a decade. And they found that over 3 to 4 years, the number of elk that are using the bridge rather than going across a freeway has shifted. So there's more than 90-95% are using the bridge. They're finding it safer. Yeah, and they move easily across it. As a matter of fact, we just got some recent infrared video of the Gold Creek crossing structure. Now, that's an underpass there right near Hyack, with a herd of elk moving under the freeway as semi-trucks were rushing along across the top of the freeway. That shows that it works.
Won't predators just hang out on the overpass for some easy pickings?
Well, they might, but you have to remember that if it's the elk or the deer, they're moving. They don't move across the freeway, you know, every day. They're moving to higher ground or to lower winter feeding areas. So yeah, you might have a cougar hanging out there and get a meal at that time, but that's going to last that cougar, let's say, a week. The deer aren't going to be there the next week. He's got to follow them. That's what he does. And he or she, and they know where the best place, the hunting places are. If this is one of them, so be it. It's not really going to affect the overall population of the deer or elk.
If my timing is just right or just wrong, will my kids in the back seat watch the cougar killing elk as we drive by?
I don't think so. One, it probably will happen at night. Two, the way it's designed is the center part of the overpass is actually going to be lower than the edges, so that wildlife, who are not particularly fond of lots of noise and light coming from trucks and other vehicles, will have a more secure path through there. So you're probably not going to see them. What we're trying to do is work with DOT to get some cameras up there and have a website where people can actually click on it and see what's going on that overpass.
Finally, Charlie, you are a wildlife conservationist. You don't usually work with freeway construction firms. Is there a lesson here for you in groups that are often opposed or sometimes opposed coming together?
This is actually one of the most rewarding projects I've worked on. Not only are we going to see a really great project in the end, but 17 years ago we went into this thing, and the conservationists and the Department of Transportation were pretty much butting heads. The Department of Transportation said, we do highways, we don't do wildlife, we're saying you need to do it. There was a couple of years of very tense conversations between the conservation groups, the other federal agencies, the wildlife and the Forest Service, and DOT, and we finally all came together and said, look, we can improve that freeway, we can take care of the avalanche situation, and make it a much better place for wildlife. Not make it any worse, but actually make it better for wildlife, so that what you had is all these different parties coming together says, that's the kind of project we can all get behind. And in fact, we did. And that meant when we went to the legislature saw this as a priority and was willing to fund it.
You see that cooperation being harder these days?
Oh, it's much harder nowadays. I'm sorry to see the partisanship and the divisiveness in the political conversations. It makes this kind of collaboration much more difficult. And so we're missing opportunities to do projects just like the I-90 Wildlife Bridges.
Charlie Raines is director of the I-90 Wildlife Bridges Coalition. Charlie, thank you for explaining to us how it's going to work. We're all going to watch it being built. Maybe there'll be DOT cameras, as you said. Thank you for coming on.
Yep, thank you so much.
That wildlife overpass is expected to be finished by the fall of 2019. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. It's The Record on KUOW. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. In Seattle Public Schools, the percentage of homeless students has doubled in the past 5 years. At some schools now, one out of every five students is homeless. But as reporter Ann Dornfeld from KUOW's Race and Equity team found, the school district doesn't give much extra help to schools with huge homeless populations.
Lowell Elementary School sits across from million-dollar houses on a quiet street in Capitol Hill. Inside this school are some of the poorest children in the city. 20% of Lowell students were homeless at last count. But even at this school, being without stable housing still carries a stigma among children.
The goal is not to let them know that you live in a shelter so they can't really judge you about it. When they ask you where you live, you say, I just don't want to talk about it.
Matthew Hicks is in fourth grade at Lowell. His sister Mariah is in second grade. Matthew and Mariah are Black. More than three quarters of homeless families in King County are people of color. The school district wouldn't let me visit any classrooms at Lowell, but it was easy to find students like Matthew where he was living, at Mary's Place. Lowell is the assigned elementary school for all of the downtown homeless shelters. That means as shelters swell with families who've lost affordable housing, so does the population of homeless students at Lowell. Matthew's mom, Tiffany Hicks, says those kids come to school with a lot on their minds.
You go through the shelter life, and then you go to school with all that stuff inside. Why are we still here? Why do we still have to go through this communal eating? Why don't we have our own stuff? And they're bitter, and they're hurt, and they're angry.
Hicks says she saw how those feelings manifest at school when she got hired as a recess monitor at Lowell last spring.
It's just a big mess. It really is. And it's sad because the students are not getting what they need.
Parents and staff alike report children storming out of class to wander the halls. Brawls on the playground, the school bus, and in the cafeteria. Classrooms in a state of near anarchy. Matthew Hicks says he gets picked on a lot. And he doesn't always get the help he needs from adults.
They'll be like, you guys got to settle it. You're fourth grade now. You guys got to do it by yourself. Do it by ourselves. We're still little. I can't do that.
Tiffany Hicks says the school isn't even close to having the resources to handle students' tremendous needs. She says it was hard to watch as a school employee. She quit after a couple of months. Staff turnover is high at Lowell. By one count, 15 teachers and administrators have left since January. Nakisha Holmes is one of them. She was the assistant principal at Lowell, someone parents and staff told me was the heart of the school. She was also the only person of color in the school administration.
I like to say Lowell has everything worth fighting for. That's where the most important work and need was in education.
But Holmes says working there became a struggle. She says the amount of uncertainty in the lives of homeless students makes them feel powerless.
So when they arrive into the classroom, they bring all that angst with them. And for the most part, don't come in with those coping skills to get them to a place where they can access the learning.
Many kids who've been through that much trauma can be easily set off, Holmes says, and most teachers lack the training to prevent those eruptions and to de-escalate them. Instead, Holmes says, there was an endless stream of upset children in her office, and only one of her.
Teachers are asking, begging for more training on how to, you know, work with students on how to teach them coping strategies and self-regulation strategies. And that's a hard place for a teacher to be when you can recognize what the kids need, but you don't have the skills to give them that.
Like all high-poverty schools, Lowell qualifies for extra funding. But it gets little special attention or resources to reflect its incredibly high homeless population. Last year, there was just one half-time counselor for the whole school. There's a social worker, but no school psychologist. A behavioral intervention specialist was hired last year, and parents and staff praise his work. But he says his job was phased out without explanation. Many parents, students, and staff members complained that the district should have hired a principal for the school who was skilled in working with such a vulnerable population. The Lowell principal declined multiple requests for an interview, and a district spokeswoman refused to respond to the numerous allegations about the school and issued this statement by email. The district can't discuss personal student information or incidents. We have a commitment to creating the best educational experience for all students. Seattle Public Schools Deputy Superintendent Stephen Nielsen did say that he was not aware of the staff exodus at Lowell. He says the district does what it can to serve homeless students, but money is tight.
The headline is obviously we don't have enough money to serve the needs of the kids. We don't have enough money to serve their transportation needs. We don't have enough money from the state. We certainly don't have enough money from the feds. And we want to do a very good job in serving these students because we want them to get an education.
Nielsen says the district does train staff to work with students on social and emotional issues, and it has a team of staff dedicated to meeting the federal law that mandates equal access for homeless students.
We have 8 people who work across the district to go in and help the homeless students in all kinds of needs that they may have and to integrate them into a meaningful academic experience where they can improve their student achievement.
Teachers and parents at Lowell say they haven't seen much evidence of that work. Louisiana State University's Carrie Tobin studies the effects of homelessness on school children. Tobin says it's critical for schools to do whatever they can to help homeless students.
The problem is, in the United States, we don't have a lot of other social supports. We don't have social policy that would take care of students' needs, and schools have really become one-stop service centers.
Tobin says while budgets are typically tight, there are inexpensive steps schools can take. The biggest is training staff in how to work with students experiencing trauma and how young brains work if they've been through intensely painful and scary experiences.
I mean, a lot of our students could probably be qualified as having something akin to PTSD.
Schools can also incorporate homelessness into curricula to help kids develop empathy and cut down on bullying. For Nakisha Holmes, the former assistant principal at Lowell, the district's budget is not the limiting factor. She grew up poor and Black in Seattle, and she says what's happening at Lowell is symptomatic of the racism and classism in this well-off, mostly white city. Holmes says the district does not go nearly far enough in making sure that the schools that need the most help get what they need, like one where 1/5 of students have no permanent address. She says if that comes at the expense of affluent schools, that has to be okay.
It's time to have some real conversations with everybody that's impacted and come up with a clear action plan and be willing to piss some people off, hurt some feelings. I mean, everybody's not going to be happy in this scenario.
I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Earlier this hour, we were discussing how to make Seattle more affordable and how much Amazon should help. KUOW is launching a podcast all about Amazon. You can hear a preview and subscribe when you go to kuow.org/primed. Now, here's an idea for making Seattle more affordable. Make it harder to buy real estate here purely as an investment. Seattle Mayor candidate Carrie Moon wants a tax on home purchases if you don't live in that home.
Housing should be reserved for people who want to live and work here. It should not be treated like a commodity because the more outside players from Wall Street or sovereign wealth funds are coming in to buy up our housing, the less housing is available for folks who want to live here.
Moon says if you want to see this profiteering at work, just look at Vancouver, BC, where homes are even more expensive than they are here. Vancouver has imposed a 15% foreign buyer's tax to discourage non-Canadian speculators from flipping homes. And yesterday, Vancouver went even further. Here to tell you about that is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill. Locals first.
Yes. Why is Vancouver giving local residents first crack at buying new condo units?
They've had the experience in Vancouver for a while of condo towers being pre-sold, sometimes before they're even built.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been happening is that the locals, you'll get these scenes, local people will line up to the housing office for the project office, and go in and try to buy and be told, nope, sorry, it's all sold. It's pre-sold to people with connections to the developers, with people given the inside track, with prime buyers of the realtor that is handling the project. And often, certainly anecdotally, these people are not even residents of British Columbia, never mind Vancouver or the Metro Vancouver region. And the city council has heard enough complaints from the public. They're trying to take action. Last night, the locals' first motion passed through council by a vote of 7-2, led by Mayor Gregor Robertson, who made the motion himself.
How is this going over with British Columbians who live outside Vancouver but who might like to live there?
Well, they're going to make some allowance. There's one municipality near Vancouver, one of those suburbs, that's already done this. And they have a local first rule. So this is West Vancouver. And their rule is, I think, for the first 30 days, you have to be from West Vancouver. But then people from the entire region of Metro Vancouver, so all of the other municipalities, have an in for 60 days. So it's kind of a two-step system. And Vancouver hasn't put together the entire policy that will flow from the spirit of this motion, but I think that's the way they're headed as well. They will have a preference for people that live and work in Vancouver, a second layer of preference for people who live and work in the region, and only then, if they don't want the places, do the outsiders, the foreigners, get to have an in.
Yes, the outsiders and the foreigners, Vaughn. Is there evidence that Vancouver's foreign buyer tax and now a locals first rule on new condos, is there evidence that these are driven by xenophobia or racism?
Well, you know, people say no. They're worried about local access and all that. But, you hate to admit it, but I think there's a factor that an awful lot of these people are overseas Chinese that are coming in and buying the property for speculative purposes. They're seen as having an inside track through some of the realty companies and some of the development companies that are owned by, non-resident British Columbians. So, I think people are careful and they have their reasons, but the mayor was pretty defensive about it last night. He said this is not about a racist motion, but I think there's an element of it in the public backlash. I think people would be angry about housing affordability anyway, but I think it's a dimension. I wouldn't get carried away about it, but I think it's a factor. You know, that 15% foreign buyer's tax that we brought in last summer initially had a huge effect. I mean, prices leveled off. Some prices for some kinds of housing crashed, but everything's climbing again. I don't know if it's just because the foreign buyers have figured out a workaround or just that we've got so little housing compared to the massive amount of demand to live in our region. I mean, it's an attractive city. It's a great place to live. You know this story in Seattle, right? Mm. And we're running out of land, We're not making that anymore. So, it's a tough, tough thing for governments. They want to show they're doing something. But most of the stuff we've done so far, I guess it's helped, but it certainly hasn't solved the problem.
So the foreign buyer tax hasn't solved the problem. We'll watch this locals first rule. You're right, Vaughn. The people of greater Seattle are looking to your town, even more expensive than it is to live here, and we're having a mayor's race and debating what to do about it. Vaughn Palmer, columnist at the Vancouver Sun. Great to talk with you again, Vaughn. Thank you.
I wish people in Seattle good luck, and thanks, Bill.
Uh-huh. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We all know marital infidelity is wrong. And we know what happens after an affair. The cheated on half of the couple either forgives the cheater or the relationship could be over.
It's not the affair that hurts. It's the betrayal. Like, it's not the sex part. It's that somebody else was more important, I guess. I don't know.
You know, it was more about just feeling like I didn't have, like, a connection anymore. We didn't talk anymore. And then eventually it just became easy to, you know, you get attention from somebody else and it just, you sort of grab onto it.
That is a couple trying to work through infidelity on therapist Esther Perel's podcast. Perel's been working with couples for more than 3 decades, and she says we need to start thinking about infidelity differently. Esther Perel, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The book is called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. First of all, are we talking about sexual infidelity? About even thinking fondly or deeply about someone outside your relationship? What do you mean by infidelity?
In the digital age, the definition of infidelity keeps on expanding. Is it a love affair? Is it a hookup? Is it a lap dance? Is it watching porn? Is it staying secretly active on your dating apps when you're already steady with someone? You can have today, for the first time, an affair while you're lying next to your partner in bed. You can engage online with multiple experiences that are sexual without being physical. So this is a question, and there is no universally agreed upon definition of infidelity.
And is that why you want us to, as the book says, rethink infidelity? Because now it has so many aspects, or is there also some deeper reason?
I've been a couples therapist for 34 years. I have worked all over the world with countless couples who have been shattered by the experience of infidelity. And it has the power to shake the entire foundation. And when I ask any audience, and I'm on book tour now and I'm asking it every night, have you been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life? About 80% of the people raise their hand. They've been the children of a parent who was unfaithful. They've been the friend whose shoulder is wet from the tears of someone who's been hurt and betrayed. They've been the confidant who's been brought into the enthralling stories of another. They've been the third who completes the triangle. I mean, it is systemic. And
do you think it's increasing more so than, say, a generation ago? Is there more infidelity now? But separate from, the, as you say, the many, many means
yes.
that there are.
Well, we also know that women are rapidly closing the infidelity gender gap. They have mobility. There is no fault divorce. There is a growing economic independence for women in certain parts of the world. And there is primarily, first and foremost, less of a risk of pregnancy and mortality. So for the first time, the consequences for women are less dire. She doesn't have to fear death or ostracism or destitution and all the major forces that held her very much kept at home.
I had the impression from your writing that there's also another cause of infidelity is the enormous expectation we put on what marriage is supposed to be. So that if it's fallen short of that huge expectation, well, now we start to feel justified in straying. Is that right? Marriage is supposed to be so much to us?
Look, infidelity has existed since marriage was invented, and so too the taboo against it. It has been shrouded in secrecy and in shame, and it hasn't helped the people who are actually going through the crisis. And so part of what I am writing is to come up with an approach that is a new model for an old sin, a conversation that is more caring and more compassionate. Would be nice to think that it is our model of today that makes people stray. But people have strayed. It is the only commandment that is repeated twice in the Bible. Once for doing it and once just for thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody understood human nature. But it is also true that we have today the highest relationship expectations that we've ever had. We deposit most of these expectations in one relationship. It is our one and only, which until not too long ago meant God, not my partner. And that the meaning of the betrayal is the shattering of the grand ambition of love.
Yes, we do talk about it in godly ways,
that our soulmate.
Yes, we conflate the spiritual and the relational. We look to romantic love for transcendence, for ecstasy, for belonging, for meaning. As Robert Johnson, the psychoanalyst, says, all these experiences we used to look for in the sanctuary of the divine, not in the lap of our partner.
You mentioned human nature. Are you saying that monogamy is unnatural? Is that something you tell couples?
Monogamy is a practice. It's a choice. It's an experience, a concept, a behavior that has changed throughout history. For all of history, monogamy meant one person for life. Today, monogamy is one person at a time. And people are telling you very comfortably that they are monogamous in all their relationships.
So that's the words. That's the serial monogamy.
That is the
phrase.
Serial monogamist. I mean, you know, we are no longer in the West generally virgin when we come to our marriage. We used to marry and have sex for the first time. And today you marry and you stop having sex with others. Monogamy has been a flexible concept throughout history. It's not the first time. It is part. Monogamy defined as sexual exclusivity has been intrinsically connected to the model of marriage. And it is a practice. Throughout history, people have practiced, proclaimed monogamy and clandestine adultery. But let's be clear. Monogamy was expected primarily from women. This has never been a gender equal proposition. Men all over the world practically have had a license to cheat. Women have still 9 countries where they can be killed. So this has never been a gender equal situation.
So do you tell couples that fidelity, especially male fidelity, is realistic? Is that something, are you say rethinking infidelity, are you suggesting that we move away from that model of coupledom?
When I talk about repositioning infidelity, it is in order to create a conversation that is more compassionate and more caring for the people who are struggling.
What would be a more compassionate way?
Less judgmental. Not taking a subject that is so ubiquitous, so complex and so painful, and reducing it to black and white, to good and bad, to victim and perpetrator. It is more complicated than that, and we serve nobody by keeping a discourse that is that judgmental and that dogmatic. That doesn't make it all right. That doesn't condone it. But it does demand from us that we also try to understand it so that we can actually help the people who are experiencing it, which is the majority of the population.
One way I hear you in your work reframing what infidelity is from a betrayal to something that has to do with the person who strayed, not necessarily a betrayal of the partner, that maybe the unfaithful one mm-hmm. is on a kind of mission of self-discovery. They're looking for something, right?
So one of the great findings in my research for the State of Affairs is that we tend to think that if we have everything in our relationship, there should be no reason to go looking elsewhere. If we've gone elsewhere, it means there must be something missing. Either there is something missing in our relationship or there must be something missing in you. And it is a deficiency model. It sees affairs exclusively as a symptom. And one of the great discoveries for this book was that people in satisfying relationships also find themselves cheating. And it isn't because they want to look for another person as much as they want to reconnect with a lost version of themselves.
Yeah.
The person they want to leave sometimes is not their partner, but the one that they have themselves become. And so it put the subject of longing and loss at the heart of affairs, of some kinds of affairs, together with the fact that affairs are two things. They are hurt and betrayal for one person, and they are sometimes longing and self-discovery for another. These two things exist at the same time, and that's why I began to create a model that looks at it from a dual perspective, what it did to you and what it meant for me, so that people can make sense of it and not blame the relationship and the marriage when that marriage has nothing to do with it.
So you're with a couple, and one couple is crushed and betrayed and hurt. That's how they feel. And you're pointing out that this is another way of looking at this, is that their partner is looking for something or a different version of themselves. How's that supposed to help the crushed person? What do you tell that person to do?
So that is not something that starts in the phase one. The model traces three different stages in the recovery from the crisis of affairs. And in the acute crisis, you are primarily dealing with the hurt and with the other person being able to show remorse and guilt for hurting. That we know that in all experiences that are painful and traumatic, acknowledging the wrongdoing comes first. But afterwards, it helps me a great deal to know that it wasn't because I could have done something, or I am not enough, or there's something shortcoming in me, and that my entire relationship is a lie and it's a fraud, and everything we built together for the past 26 years is just a joke. That makes a huge difference. Some affairs have nothing to do with the marriage. Some do, but it's important to make the distinction.
Is there something you can leave a listener with to just start to break that iceberg a new way of thinking can dawn on them personally if they're dealing with infidelity somehow? What's a message you want to leave a listener with?
Some affairs break a relationship, and some affairs can remake a relationship. Sometimes it's the death knell. That's it. It's a relationship that was already agonizing.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it is one of the most powerful alarm systems that leads you to reclaim your relationship, your marriage, to realize what you stand to lose, to jolt you out of your complacency, to remind you that this demands attention. And that doesn't mean that you need to have an affair to do that. You wish that people wouldn't have to go through this crisis. Like many people who get sick and have a life-threatening illness and have a whole new perspective on life, you don't want them to get sick for that. You would never recommend them to get sick. But you do realize that when you hit bottom, from there you can often rise and become more strong, more honest. Many people in the aftermath of an affair, in the crisis of an affair, will tell you that they are for the first time having conversations with a level of depth and honesty and openness that they haven't had in years.
And that's what they were hoping for when they got married to begin with.
Yes, you wish they had had these conversations earlier, that they didn't have to go through this to get there.
Esther Perel, the book is The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. Thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure.
That's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I hope we gave you a lot to think about in 1 hour, from capitalism to love and a lot in between. Thank you for listening. I look forward to talking with you again tomorrow.